Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1995, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actor. His career, as he cheerfully admits himself, has had its ups and downs, and by no means everything he's done has been of the best quality. But it seems unlikely he'll have to accept second-rate work in the future. In films such as Morris, Remains of the Day, and most recently, Four Weddings and a Funeral, he's attracted a huge following, playing parts which seem to correspond naturally to his school and Oxford background. He's now firmly established as a cinematic symbol of a certain type of Englishman, a curious cross, as someone put it, between Tigger and Lord Byron. He is Hugh Grant. Are you happy with that kind of description, Hugh? I mean, is that how you see yourself, as kind of English Cary Grant de nos jours?
Well, I don't know. There was quite a few things in that. I've got Cary Grant and Tigger and Byron. Well, yeah, Tigger certainly. The quintessential Englishman is slightly annoying. I'm not going to get annoyed, but it's slightly annoying because I like to think that my range is sensationally wide and I'm extraordinarily versatile.
Well, maybe it's going to become that. It's just how we've perceived you, I suppose, so far.
Maybe in the films that have been prominent.
But it seems to be where you're heading and where people say you're heading is for that Cary Grant, if you like, type of role, which is the intelligent, comic, leading man, which is, you know, there aren't many of them around. Are there any of them around?
Yeah, I think, that's sort of what Tom Hanks kind of does. But you're right, maybe that would account for the very surprising sort of sudden niceness of people, particularly in America. Maybe there's a shortage of people who can handle light comedy.
But your difficulty must be that because you now have this sudden celebrity, that Hollywood will just take advantage of the fact that they can put the name on the screen and they will get you into any role they can get you into.
Well, that's certainly true, that the offers that they very kindly send me now are sometimes a little extraordinary. I mean, for a time it was an awful lot of sort of wedding-y kind of scripts, and now it's just about anything that they have. I mean, I get scripts in which the leading part is an elderly Jewish lady, and you sort of say, well, why have you sent me this? And they say, well, we can fix it, Hugh. The other day someone pitched me the part of an abominable snowman and stuff like that, and I do have to be very careful, particularly as everyone's, watches very carefully now and is quite understandably dying for me to flop.
And can you now name your price?
Certainly it's gone up, and my very terrifying Hollywood agents are very good at making me almost giggle when they mention figures now.
Are you willing to confirm or deny what you did or didn't get for Four Weddings? I mean, the reports are that you got about 40 or 50,000 and it's kind of grossed 100 million or something, and you haven't got a cut of the profits.
Well, no, 40,000 I think is about right, perhaps a bit less, and which sounds like a hell of a lot, but isn't particularly much for a film part. I did actually have a 1% of the net profits, but I'm no accountant. I mean, the film was made for $5 million and has since then made nearly $300 million. But I'm told by the backers that we haven't actually made a profit yet. But who knows? Heck, what do I know about maths?
But you're better off than you were anyway.
Yeah.
Let's get down to business. Tell me about your first Desert Island Disc.
Well, what we've got here is We Don't Care, which is my favourite track from The Tale of the Flopsy Bunnies, which I'm sure the audience is familiar with, which is the Beatrix Potter story on record. The record I had when I was little was Bright Red. It was always an enormous source of amusement to me, particularly when played at 33, when Vivian Leigh's voice sounds like a man. We're going to play it at the real speed, I think, but it's almost better on 33.
When Benjamin Bunny grew up, he married his cousin Flopsy. They had a large family, and they were very improvident and very cheerful.
We don't care, we don't care, we don't care a fig. There's a lettuce in the pantry, though it isn't very big. It won't last tomorrow, I'm sorry to say, but tomorrow is another day. So, we don't care, we don't care, we don't care a bit. Though we haven't any money, we could use it, I admit.
We Don't Care, from The Tale of the Flopsy Bunnies by Beatrix Potter, narrated by Vivian Leigh at the right speed. Bunnies have obviously played an important part in your life. Weren't you the White Rabbit at school?
Yes, I was, yes. It was my first dramatic role. I was the White Rabbit in Alice in Wonderland.
How old?
I was 28. No, I was, I don't know, six or something like that, and I thought terribly good. It's a role I've always wanted to recreate.
So you've kept the costume,
then? I got the costume, got the ears. I'm just looking for the right occasion.
And then there was Hugh Grant, I think, as Brigitta, the second daughter in the Von Trapp family in The Sound of Music.
Yeah, I think she's the fourth daughter, actually, Sue. And, yes, I was one of the girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes.
And plaits.
And plaits, yeah.
So
yeah.
You've had some success as animals and girls.
Animals and girls, yes. Those were my favourite parts, but they are hard to come by now.
And school productions generally were your forte, were they? Is that what you did at school?
Well, I had an extraordinarily high opinion of my own acting abilities at school, not really shared by the others, but people were very nice to me. I mean, I had a very good English teacher who was a great guru of actors, and he sort of helped Mel Smith into the business and Alan Rickman and then myself.
But apparently, sickeningly, you were brainy too. You were on. You represented your school in Top of the Form, didn't you?
Well, I did. I'm ashamed to say there was a big quiz to see who would go on it, and I think the same very nice master who was helping me into show business was so keen to have me on the radio that he cheated and put me on Top of the Form, even though my general knowledge wasn't up to it. And it backfired. I was hopeless. I mean, it got to the point where the question master actually laughed when he came to me. He'd go, and now it's Hugh's turn. And I don't think I got one question right. Mind you, they were very, very difficult.
This was Latimer Upper School?
Yeah.
Hammersmith, West London?
Yeah.
The teachers apparently thought you were wonderful, and the parents thought you were wonderful when you appeared on the stage and kept saying, he'll go far. This is what I read about you.
Oh, really?
What did the boys think of you?
Well, I think I had friends. They slightly despised me for being a bit small, I think. And I think I went through one or two rather posy phases. I certainly had a communist phase, which was deeply embarrassing to everyone concerned. But I think on the whole, I had friends, and I had an extraordinarily nice time, and perhaps it's uncool, but a lot of my best friends are still my friends from Latimer.
You say you were a bit small, and this is your opportunity, really, to give heart to all those adolescents who think they're never going to grow up and be cool. You wore, is this true, platform shoes?
Platform boots. Well, so did everyone, so that it meant that even the boys who were tall were even taller, so I never caught up. But, yes, I mean, in those days, you did at least have that option, that you could go to Shelley's and get something for $9.99 made of plastic, which made your feet smell very badly. But,
and did you fail to get the girls because you looked so sweet and angelic? And
yes, to a certain extent, I think that's true. I remember one or two unfortunate dates. Yeah.
What about your family? Tell me about them. What did your father and mother do? Or what do they do?
Well, Mum was and still is a teacher, and my father was in a carpets business. But he retired as soon as he possibly could because his passion was always watercolours, and that's what he does full-time now.
And your mother apparently didn't or doesn't approve of the acting profession.
I think she was a little bit wary of me going into it. She used to say, "'Tis really prostitution, isn't it, darling?" But I think she's come round to it a bit since it started to sort of go right for me.
Tell me about record number two.
Well, this is the reel of the 51st Highland Division, played by Jimmy Shand and his band. My father's whole family is Scottish, and we used to spend all our holidays up there in the north of Scotland, near Inverness, and we used to go to these balls and dance these reels. And the reel of the 51st is particularly special because it was actually invented by my grandfather and his fellow officers in prison of war camp in Germany. And I always liked the image of them dancing around together in whatever it was, Offleg 54. You can sit down again now, Susan.
The reel of the 51st Highland Division, played by Jimmy Shand and his band. Tell me about Hugh Grant at Oxford. You won a scholarship to read English at New College.
Yes.
What kind of figure did you cut?
I don't know. I think, you know, everyone's a little bit posy at that stage, and I think, you know, I could pose along with the best of them. I think I was fine for the first year and stuck with my old school friends and was nice and diligent and everything. And then just slightly went off that track and...
Onto what kind of track?
Well, I think I got very into the 30s poets, into Auden and, you know, Isherwood and Spender and those people. And I'm afraid I used to do my top button up and wear lots of V-neck jumpers and smoke cigarettes, even though they made me feel sick. It was the seediness of those poets, I think, that attracted me.
Did you consciously work at your voice? I mean, when you become famous as you have, then all sorts of contemporaries come out of the woodwork, don't they, and start writing about you or talking to the press about you. Mm. And what some of yours out of the woodwork have said is that your vowels made a rapid ascent up the scale at some point.
Well, I actually don't think that is true. I mean, I'm you know, my favourite game is to do myself down, but I really don't think in that particular case it's true. I mean, the way I speak now is more or less how my parents speak, and that's how I always spoke at home. I think there was a phase at school where I, you know, went a bit more London, and I remember my parents coming to speech day, and neither they nor, in fact, I realised that that's how I spoke at school, to fit in. And I remember I recited, "Good afternoon, to smash 'em up, we're having tea, you do have a cup." And, you know, they were very astonished and pointed it out to me. But I think by the time I got to Oxford, I was just with my own voice.
Why is your favourite game to do yourself down? Self-deprecation is kind of your style, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult when, you know, when you're doing interviews. What are you supposed to say, you know? It's very difficult to blow your own trumpet. I'm not saying I'm a naturally modest person, but it's just a good interview gambit,
I suppose. It's a way of getting around it.
Yeah.
So you acted at Oxford, you were in Ouds, and you made a film, I think, didn't you?
Yes, we did a film called Privileged. I don't think the director would mind me saying it was one of the most pretentious films ever made, especially as I've now made another film with him just this last year called Restoration. He's a big Hollywood director now. But Privileged was pretty awful, but got an extraordinary amount of attention when it came out.
Next record.
This is a bit of Nabucco, Verdi's Nabucco. It's the entry of the Hebrew slaves. Before I went to Oxford, I spent a lot of time in Italy. I was going through a very arty phase and went round Italy looking at paintings and making embarrassing notes, and I think this was one of the records that accompanied me.
Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Verdi's Nabucco, played by the Vienna Opera Orchestra, conducted by Lamberto Gardelli. Was there a moment when you decided to become an actor then? I mean, presumably you had to earn a living. There was no great family money, despite the image.
No, there wasn't really any family money, and it wasn't a big, grand decision to suddenly become an actor. After I graduated, I actually had a place at the Courtauld Institute in London to do a DPhil in History of Art. And I was a little bit unsure about whether that's what I really wanted to do. And while I was just sort of waiting to start that summer, this film Privileged came out, and agents came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, you can make your star." And I suddenly thought, well, maybe at least I can do this for a year while I make up my mind what I really want to do. So I did it, assuming that it would be, I'd be a star overnight, and, you know, that would be a cool thing to say at dinner parties. And of course, it's not like that at all. You have to get into equity and all that kind of stuff. So, I ended up having to go into rep. I ended up at Nottingham Playhouse doing very, very small parts.
What was your first role there, do you remember?
Tree in Wind was my first part. And then I did Shouting Peasant. and then I did Footman in Lady Windermere's Fan. There isn't a footman, but they had to write him in specially to give me something to do.
Now, you play a character in your latest film, An Awfully Big Adventure, Meredith Potter, who runs a kind of rep company like that, don't you? Did you base him in some way on someone you knew there?
Well, yeah. The director of Nottingham at that time, I now am very fond of. In fact, I was very fond of him by the time I finished my six-month stint. But I think he would admit that he would kind of enjoyed his power over the brand new actors. And he was something of a tyrant and, you know, was quite happy to say, Hugh Grant, you're late. Your lines have been taken away and given to Paul Reeves. Or, you're very bad, aren't you, Ducky? You're pretty, but you're bad. But, so a little bit of Meredith Potter in An Awfully Big Adventure is based on him.
Meredith Potter's a pretty nasty piece of work.
Yes, he's foul.
Makes a change for you to play somebody pretty nasty.
There are a few villains during my miniseries phase, but I think he's my first real villain on the big screen. Yeah.
And was this film underway before Four Weddings came out? I mean, was it sort of pre-mass stardom, pre-big stardom?
Well, yeah, it was. We were making it this time last year in the spring in Dublin, me and Mike Newell, who directed Four Weddings, and we kept getting these faxes every week saying Four Weddings made another 10 million in America and it's now number one at the box office and stuff like that. And it was a very odd experience while we were on a very, very shoestring budget, struggling to make this very low-budget film.
Meanwhile, back in your life, age 23, after the Nottingham Playhouse, you became an alternative comedian.
Well, we weren't at all alternative. That was really the point of us, in a way. In fact, we used to do sketches about alternative comedians, but we did... it was a review. Actually, it was quite good. It was called The Jockeys of Norfolk.
Just two of you?
No, well, it began as two while we were at Nottingham and bored, and then a third guy came in, and we did it on the Fringe in London and then at the Edinburgh Festival.
So you wrote it as well?
We wrote it and performed it, and it sort of got bigger and bigger, and it was a success. But then we went on the TV, and we didn't get it quite right, to say the least.
You died.
Yes.
But you wrote commercials.
Yeah, then we went into writing rather than performing. We all got old and scared, because it's very frightening, that kind of thing.
And you were all of 25 by the
Yes, time. That's yeah. right. Yeah. And so we wrote a lot of radio commercials with Mel Smith and Griffreys Jones's company.
Can you give me one?
We did a lot for Brill Cream, and I think we were quite proud of, which were all about, and here we are in London's Soho district, and I'm talking to someone who's got very smart hair. And why do you wear Brill Cream? You know, all that kind of stuff. Here we are in the cockpit of a BOAC airliner.
But you enjoyed doing it. I mean, you enjoyed writing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something I sort of very much miss now, because I'm so busy sort of acting. But I do remember that, you know, at the end of a day's writing commercials for Red Stripe Lager or dog food, I somehow felt a bit more of a man than at the end of a day's filming on even a big Hollywood film. Strange.
Why?
It just takes a little more brain power, really, a little more effort.
Record number four.
This is Wham, which will be a treat for everyone, with Wake Me Up Before You Go, Go, which is what we used to play to ourselves, the Jockeys of Norfolk, before we went on stage to try and get some energy together. And it worked so well that we started to actually play it to the audience as well, at full volume. The Edinburgh audience in particular hated it. Wake me up before you go, go. Don't leave me hanging on like a yo-yo. Wake me up before you go, go. I don't want to miss it when you hit that high. Wake me up before you go, go. Cause I'm not planning on going solo. Wake me up before you go, go. Take me dancing tonight. I want to hit that high.
Wham! And Wake Me Up Before You Go, Go. Your big break, Hugh Grant, came in 1986, when you would have been 26, when you were offered a part in a feature film, Morris, by Merchant Ivory. That's the story of E.M. Forster's early homosexual experiences. That must have been very exciting. I mean, it's a beautiful film.
Well, it is a nice film, you're right. I'm very proud of it, especially now, you know, with a bit of distance between me and it. I can see that. I was very heavily into, you know, writing and stuff at the time. I remember my agent called up and said, you know, go and meet James Ivory. And I said, well, I don't think so. You know, I'm a bit bored of acting now. I'm into writing. And he said, no, go on. I went and I got this part, and that put me on the sort of cinema track. It's a strange system. Once you've done one film, you're somehow qualified to do others.
But do you become kind of typecast? I mean, again, you were there. It was Cambridge, wasn't it? Not Oxford, but nevertheless, rich, young, undergraduate, charming and good-humoured. And then, of course, Charles in Four Weddings is well-heeled and charming again. And then there's Hugh Grant, who's well-heeled these days, charming, good-humoured. I mean, where does the acting end and reality begin? Or are you these people, or is part of you these people?
That's a difficult question. I mean, because there was something like 7 years between those two parts, and in between there were an awful lot of other things, you know, or not at all sort of upper class or quintessentially English or particularly charming. And so I think that's the answer to that bit. And I don't, as far as am I like that, yes, up to a point, but I think there's also a sort of darker side and a sort of perhaps colder side.
Yeah, Mike Newell has said, in fact, I think he's in print as saying that there is a colder side to you, that you don't suffer fools, that you, I think he said, you have a cruel streak.
Well, I think that's a bit unfair. I think I'm quite kind, actually, but maybe the suffering fools is true.
What form does the darker side take, then?
I'm pretty irritable, and I can, if I think people are being dim, I'm quite ready to put them down.
And it's that darker side that you don't want to reveal when you give interviews, therefore you take the wry, self-deprecating line, and then that can get you into trouble as well.
Well, as you probably know, almost anything can get you into trouble in an interview. It's a lose-lose situation, as the Americans say.
But I presume there's part of you that would be perfectly happy if you never had to do another interview in your life.
Absolutely delighted. Not part of me, an entire part of me. I mean, my whole self.
But would you be happier writing from everything you said? You'd probably... Well, prefer to be behind the pen.
Maybe, baby. Maybe. I'm not sure. I think I have to certainly cash in now that things are going well for me as an actor. And, you know, it is interesting to be in a situation where I can more or less do what I like. That's fun. But I think I would be quite happy if I ended up just writing. Yeah.
Next record. Number 5, it is, you know.
Yeah, this is... another favourite record from my childhood. It was always the favourite on Housewife's Choice and things. I don't know why I always listened to Housewife's Choice, but I did, and it's The Laughing Policeman, sung by Charles Penrose.
I know a fat old policeman, he's always on our street. A fat and jolly red-faced man, he really is a treat. He's too kind for a policeman, he's never known to frown, and everybody says he is the happiest man in town.
Charles Penrose and The Laughing Policeman. When did you meet Elizabeth Hurley? Because you and she have been together for some years, haven't you?
Yeah, we met doing a film in Spain called Remando al Viento, or Rowing with the Wind, which was, I think, the first of my Euro puddings, which are these films which... Actually, they make slightly fewer of them now than they used to, but they were quite fashionable in the 80s, where they would be directed by a Spaniard, starring some Spanish actors, some Italian actors, some English actors, written in Spanish but translated incredibly badly into English.
And what was this film like? Can you give me a flavour of it?
Well, it was heaven, really. I was playing Lord Byron, and Elizabeth was Claire Claremont. And, I don't know, it'd be lines like, deep down in the lake there is slimy lichen, but when you look at the surface you see only your own reflection. That is how you are, Claire. And then when she undressed me, I remember the great line, she gets to my boots, and I have to say, not my boots, ever, because, of course, I have a club foot. Although in Remando al Viento I had 2 club feet, because the Spanish director thought that was more interesting, but made walking very difficult in the film. But they're classic, those films. I mean, they're great ones. Elizabeth did a very good German one. The Germans are particularly arrogant about their idea of English, and, I mean, she had lines like, don't look at me like that, shave pig. And when she'd say to the director, you know, I'm not sure about this word shave pig. It's not really very colloquial in English. They say, oh, yes, no, it's good English. Yes, you say shave pig.
And she only fancied you because of your costume in the first instance, apparently.
Correct.
She fancied Lord Byron, not Hugh Grant.
Absolutely right, and still does to this day.
But she now, of course, is famous in her own right because she's, in case anybody hasn't heard, the new face of Estee Lauder. It must be an enormous pressure living in the kind of goldfish bowl that you inhabit at the moment, you two.
It is quite tiring, to tell the truth, yes. I'm relatively all right. I mean, I'm the one that gets shouldered aside so they can get pictures of Elizabeth. You know, I'm OK, but I think it's a bit miserable for her. But to be honest with you, it's still quite titillating as well, you know, because I've never had any recognition before. And you can't really moan. And, you know, sometimes you think, well, it would be nice if the tabloids didn't dig up every skeleton and, you know, lie and smear and all those things. But on the other hand, when they lie and smear and poke fun at other celebrities, and it gives me enormous delight. So I can't be too hypocritical.
And I'm told clothes play an important part still in this relationship. Not your Byron-esque stuff, but you like buying clothes for Elizabeth, is that right?
Well, she's passionate about clothes, yes. And I developed a taste for, you know, taking her out and sort of supervising her shopping. I love sitting on sofas in smart boutiques, being given cups of coffee by the assistants, and, you know, her coming out of the changing room and...
And you saying yes or no?
It's tacky, really. You know, anything a little lady wants, she can have. But that's me.
And you aren't married. Like Charles in Four Weddings, he was wary of commitment. Is there an overlap there between reality and fiction?
Yes, I don't know, really. I haven't quite analysed it, Mum. But it's a hard one.
Pressure from Mum?
Well, no, actually, that's not fair. There's maybe been no pressure from Mum at all. I don't know. I suppose it is a fear of commitment, or it just seems very grown up, really. I mean, it's something we never talk about, either Elizabeth or me.
Do you still feel very boyish? I mean, you part of your act is boyish. Is that is that really you?
Yeah, I think it might be. It might be. I mean, look at my record collection, for God's sake, you know. The Flopsy Bunnies and The Laughing Policeman.
And now what? What's number six?
Well, this is a bit more grown up, but this is Elizabeth and mine's sort of theme song, because it was, for some reason, a song that we were always playing when we were in Spain together and making Roman del Viento, called Something Stupid, which is, of course, Frank and Nancy Sinatra singing a minor third apart, which is something that Elizabeth and I have tried to do to the grotesque embarrassment of our friends.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something.
Frank and Nancy Sinatra singing Something Stupid. I can't leave questions about your love life without asking about Madonna. Is it true she rang you up and asked you for a date?
No, fiction.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. You seem to have responded to it in the past and said, oh, yes, you know, I didn't want to go or something.
No. I thank the press for my response.
Actually. But Robert Redford asked you out at some point and you did accept, is that right?
He didn't ask me out. We were at the Sundance Festival last year with Four Weddings and a Funeral, and he hosts a lunch, a big lunch for all the filmmakers, and I saw him heading in my direction and thought, oh, this is great, Robert Redford's coming up to be nice to me. And he went straight past me to Elizabeth and invited her skiing and on his private mountain. And I'm afraid I tagged along, sort of sad, cuckold.
You now have what seems like a terrific deal, because you and Liz have your own company set up in London, but backed by American money to do what films you fancy. Is that about it?
That's exactly it, yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't know that this was something that you could do, but apparently it is in Hollywood. It's quite common that actors who are sort of hot get these deals with the studios whereby the studio pays all your overheads and pays for your assistant and will, for instance, buy novels that you want the rights to and things like that for you.
But
and
normally people stay in Hollywood and do it. You said you didn't want to do that.
No, well, you know, I wanted to... I live here, and also I thought it'd be interesting to try and winkle out other Richard Curtises and try and do more.
Richard Curtis, who wrote Four Weddings.
Yeah.
So you can read any script you like or pick up any novel you like, and if you say to your American backers, Ted Turner is behind the money, isn't he?
Well, he owns Castle Rock, and it's Castle Rock is the company.
But you can say to them, I fancy this. I fancy writing it, or directing it, or starring in it, or...
I can't say directing it, necessarily. I mean, they're interested in me starring in it, really. And so I'll say, you know, we found this fantastic novel, let's adapt it into a screenplay, and they will either buy it for me or not. If they don't believe in it, then I have a discretionary fund of a certain amount, which I can use to buy it. And then, then we find a good writer. But it's much harder than I thought, to be absolutely honest with you. Really good screenwriting is a very rare talent, and we know Richard Curtis can do it, and we know Alan Bennett can do it, but there's not many other English writers who are that experienced in big screenwriting.
You made a very enigmatic remark to someone recently. You said, I have a few more cards to play than people think. What did you mean by that?
I don't know. I can't remember making it, but perhaps sometimes I'm a little... You know, I feel a little patronised, you know, when people think I'm just sort of a fluffy, charming, floppy-haired Hugh. And I like to think there's a bit more to me than that.
Record number 7.
Oh, this is one of the choruses from The Gondoliers. Well, it's not a chorus, in fact, it's a duet. It goes, we're called Gondolieri. Again, this goes back to my Nottingham Playhouse days, this was one of the shows we did. I was something like 81st Gondolier, and I had to mouth instead of sing because my singing's so bad.
We're called Gondolieri, but that's a baguette. It's quite honorary, the trade that we ply. For gallantry noted, since we were short-coated, to a beauty devoted, Giuseppe and I. When morning is breaking, our couches forsaking, to greet their awaking, with carols we come. At summer day's nooning, when weary lagooning, the melody is tuning, with days and in love. The melody is tuning, with ages and ages in love. The melody is tuning, with days and in love.
We're called Gondolieri from The Gondoliers, sung by Richard Lewis and John Cameron. You don't know how to play all this music, because I understand you have no facility for playing music. I mean, you've never owned a record.
Elizabeth has one now, but it is true that I've, as people will have gathered by now, I've always been a terrible musical ignoramus, really. I mean, I still, couldn't tell you for sure how to play a CD.
Well, you get the wind-up job on the island, so it's all right. It's very
simple. Oh, is that what I get?
Yes, with the old needle. You've got to change the needle from time to time out of the
OK, fine, and I can play Flopsy Bunnies at the wrong speed.
Exactly. It's time to set sail, really. What are your regrets, then, as you leave the mainland, leave all this great celebrity behind you?
Well, I mean, at this precise moment, if I was getting on the boat, it would be nothing but complete and utter pleasure. I can't think of anything I'd like to do more. As long as I had some sun cream, I think I'd be the happiest man alive.
But you wouldn't be pampered. I thought you liked, you liked the sort of...
Well, you see, I'm imagining a very luxurious island. I keep thinking of Club Med, but I think that's foolish. I've got to get into my head. All right, I'm alone, and it's quite brutal sometimes.
There are no native girls with fans and fresh pineapples. I mean, this is on your own stuff.
Yeah,
this
right.
Is, SAS stuff.
Well, it is true that I do like to be pampered. But on the other hand... A little bit of solitary confinement would be absolutely perfect, isn't it?
And you'd have time to work out, to exercise and look after your body, which is something I gather you never do.
Well, no. I mean, I play football with the Victoria and Albert team, which is no mean team, every Wednesday. But otherwise, I've never been a gym girl, really. No.
And there's no beer on the island, which you also like, which goes with the football.
Yes, that's hell.
Yeah, it's going to be hell.
All right,
for you,
then.
Really.
All right. It's hell. I'm dreading it. I changed my mind. I'm miserable. And I'm blaming you.
Last record.
Football comes up neatly here because this is one of the great moments in my life when Fulham, my beloved Fulham, got to the FA Cup final in 1975. We lost to West Ham undeservedly. And this was our FA Cup final song. It's rather beautiful.
Down at Fulham Road, we're burning with ambition. The first division is where we want to be. And if you've seen what a team we've got this season, you know the reason, we'll get there easily. But first we're heading down a Wembley way to show the world that we can really play. Oh, this year we're gonna win the cup.
Fulham Cup Squad and Viva El Fulham. Which one of those eight
records? Do you think that's the worst record ever to be on Desert Island Discs?
No, I think it's terrific. It's got real atmosphere. I'm being very nice. Come on, which one of those eight, if you could only take one of them?
It's very hard, but I think it would have to be Frank and Nancy.
Something Stupid.
Yeah.
Memories of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
On your desert island.
Yeah.
What about your book?
Again, it's tricky, but I'm going to have to go for King Otica's Scepter, which is my favourite Tintin book.
There's a lot of childhood in this discussion.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I would like to have that analysed. but it's a very special book. I don't know if you've read it.
I haven't. No.
And it's lovely. And I actually did a recording of it with my brother when we were about 7 and 9 in falsetto voices.
What about your luxury?
I think I'm going to go for a hanky, because I have a terrible nose-blowing problem, especially when I wake up. I think it would just be so miserable to have a runny nose and nothing to blow it on, apart from leaves.
Any particular kind of hanky? I mean, are you particular about these things.
No, no, just big and cotton, you know.
Bit of Irish. We can give you an endless supply of Irish linen handkerchiefs.
No, I don't like that. Oh, I don't like that. It's too rough.
I see. Nice plain
cotton. Can't have linen against my skin. Can't have wool against my skin either. That's why I had to leave the SAS. Balaclava.
Hugh Grant, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Pleasure. Pleasure. It was very nice of you to have me.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.